Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The Democratic primaries will wrap up on June 15th, a week after California's primary. With Hillary Clinton's delegate lead over Bernie Sanders, she's almost certain to get the Democratic Party nomination. But on Sunday, Senator Sanders said he hopes to win more pledged delegates in the 14 remaining primaries and caucuses, but he also acknowledged that he has a tough road to climb. He is urging party insiders, also known as Democratic superdelegates, to vote for him, particularly those in states where he has won the contests or those who committed to Clinton before he entered the race. So in Washington state, for example, Bernie Sanders won the caucus with 73% of the vote, but Hillary Clinton has 10 superdelegates from the state and Sanders has none. According to an Associated Press tally, out of 719 superdelegates, Hillary Clinton has 520 and Bernie Sanders has 39. The Democratic nominee needs 2,383 delegates to clinch the nomination. Now, the superdelegates are getting a lot of attention on the Democratic side, not so much on the Republican side. They also have superdelegates, but they have far less power and autonomy than the superdelegates on the Democratic side. And that is because the parties set their own rules. So what do you think of this process? Many argue that superdelegates undermine the democratic election process in the United States. So on today's Your Call, we are taking a look at the history of superdelegates, the party insiders that can potentially pick the party's nominee. We're also going to talk about primaries. For example, independents are allowed to vote in today's primary in Indiana, but they were not allowed to vote in New York. And in New York, there are 3 million independents, and they were not allowed to vote. Joining us to talk about all of these issues is Lawrence Lessig, professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School and founder of Root Strikers, a network opposed to corruption in government. Professor Lessig has authored a number of books, including Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Our Congress and a Plan to Stop It. On April 15th, Professor Lessig was arrested for protesting with the group Democracy Spring in Washington. The group is calling for free and fair elections and an end to the corruption of big money in politics. Professor Lessig ran for president on a single-issue platform of reforming campaign finance, and he joins us from the studios of Harvard University. Hi, Professor Lessig. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So there's a lot to talk about, and it's been so interesting to watch a lot of people pay attention to superdelegates. These issues are getting more attention because by now we usually have a nominee, and for the first time, we in California feel like our vote actually matters. So what are your thoughts about this sort of crash course that a lot of people are getting on how this nominating process works?
Well, I think it's good. I think it's important to understand what the role of the superdelegates is. It's also helpful to put it in a little context. You know, this issue really kicks off about 50 years ago after the 1968 convention, the debacle in Chicago, which really framed grassroots insurgent Democrats against establishment Democrats. And what happened after that is McGovern and Frazier put together a committee to say, how should the process be changed? And they opened up the nominating process to be a much more democratic, in a small d sense of the word, nominating process. And that led to the selection of candidates like George McGovern and Jimmy Carter, both of whom, Carter, of course, who beat Ford, but McGovern and Carter both had resounding defeats at the polls, leading many in the Democratic Party to think we couldn't trust the Democratic people to select these insurgent candidates. So that led in 1980, Jim Hunt, who's governor from North Carolina in 1982, had a commission that put together this idea of reform of the nominating process to create these superdelegates who were meant to primarily provide a check, a governor on the process to select and to make sure that the candidate who came through was a candidate who actually could be counted on to win the election.
And The Guardian had a piece on that, and they quote Tad Devine. He's a longtime Democratic operative. He's a top strategist for Bernie Sanders. He said after the 1980 convention, when there was so few party leaders and elected officials on the floor of the convention, the party made a decision about looking at its rules and reassessing the primary process. So what do you think about this overall process, Professor Lessig? Because a lot of people are angry about it. They feel like it's just not democratic at all.
Well, I agree. There's a lot of good reasons to be skeptical about the democratic quality of our system for electing representatives and the president. You know, we exclude independents. You know, when they used to exclude black people from voting in the South, we understood there was a problem to that. But excluding independents from the process of selecting our president is viewed by at least the party insiders as not a problem at all. We also have incredible inequality produced by the way we fund campaigns, not so much at the presidential level, given what Bernie has done to demonstrate the possibility of small dollar funding, but at the congressional level, where you know, they spend 30 to 70% of their time raising money from a tiny fraction of the 1%. Now, the superdelegates could be thought of as, you know, party elites that are steering the election away from what the base of the party wants. But we actually haven't seen them use their power in that way since they were created in the 1980s. What they, you know, they affirmed Walter Mondale in 1984. There hasn't been a real fight since then. In 2008, there was a question of whether they'd play a role in that election. But this is the first time where they're going to have a choice. And what's really interesting about the way this choice is developing is when this election started, Bernie Sanders was attacking the superdelegates as being anti-democratic. You know, he said, let the people decide. And he wanted to run a race that would win on the basis of getting more votes than Hillary Clinton. Well, now that Hillary Clinton has got probably 12 million votes to his 9 million votes, the story's flipped around. And now he wants to say to the superdelegates, look, despite the fact Hillary Clinton has gotten 3 million more votes than I have, what I want you to do is to look at who's most likely to win against Donald Trump. Now, he might be right about whether he can win against Donald Trump, but all of a sudden the superdelegates are being rallied as an anti-democratic force to elect a guy over a woman by, you know, a majority of these delegates are men too, to defeat what the Democratic base of the party has through their votes said they wanted to be the nominee. And that's why it makes it so interesting. Everybody's on both sides of this fight.
Right. Well, and Bernie Sanders on Sunday pointed out that in Washington state, he won the caucuses with 73% of the vote, but Clinton has 10 superdelegates. He has none. In Colorado, he won 59% of the vote. Clinton has 10 superdelegates, and again, he has none. What do you think about that argument he's making?
Well, if it's consistent, it's a fine argument. You know, one group in here that's been incredibly consistent has been MoveOn. MoveOn, of course, supports Bernie Sanders. But MoveOn has said, look, we want the nominee to be the person who gets the most votes in the Democratic primary. And that person right now is pretty clearly going to be Hillary Clinton. She's got 3 million more votes than Bernie Sanders so far. So if Bernie's argument is that everything should be proportional to vote, okay, that's a perfectly consistent argument, but it's not an argument that yields the conclusion that Bernie Sanders is the nominee.
ABC News took a look at who these superdelegates are. And according to ABC News, on the Democratic side, it's 21 governors, 40 senators, 193 representatives, and 67 lobbyists. They didn't name these lobbyists, so we don't know if it's, say, for example, pro-choice groups or oil companies. But what strikes you about who these people actually are?
Well, it's, of course, concerning that they would be representatives of private interests because, of course, the objective of the super PAC, the objective of these super delegates was to vote in a way that advanced the interests of the Democratic Party, not the interests of oil companies or not the interests of the state of California or whatever their narrow special interest is. So, you know, I think it's possible for them to do that. The challenge they've got right now is how do you measure the interest of the Democratic Party? Do you measure it by saying who's the most likely to beat Donald Trump? Or do you measure it by saying who's the person who's actually rallied the largest number of people in the primary process? And what's making this a hard question is that those two people might be different. It might well be that Bernie Sanders has a stronger chance of beating Donald Trump than Hillary Clinton. That's what, you know, if you look at the consensus number of polls, that seems to be the answer. Maybe that's not to be believed. Maybe you think that that would his advantage would be undercut very quickly. But whatever you think, if you believe Bernie Sanders is the most likely one to win, you might say, well, to heck with what the Democratic voters have said. Let's pick the person we know is most likely to win. But if that happens, you know, the revolution in that convention in Philadelphia, I don't think is going to be on the Bernie Sanders side. I think the Hillary Clinton people are going to be saying, hey, what the heck? We've gotten more votes. We've gotten a stronger number of Democrats who said that they support us. And now you're defeating the first woman who to get to this place on the basis of this speculation of who could win in November. There's something deeply unfair about that. And I think she'd have a pretty strong argument. So this is turning out to be a really hard argument of principle for the Democratic Party. Is it the future or is it what you have earned in this process so far?
Is there anything you would change about the superdelegate process on the Democratic side, or would you leave it as is?
Well, I think it would be really important for the party to be clear about the rules up front with respect to the purpose of the superdelegates. Like, what are they supposed to do? Are they supposed to tilt the results in favor of who the consensus view is the most likely candidate to be able to win? And if that's the understanding, then let's agree on it and let's go and run a nominating process. But what's frustrating is when it feels like the rules are changing, if the perception is that the purpose and the function of these delegates is changing. The delegates have never had to make the hard choice they've got to make this time, the choice between who's likely to win and who's most likely to win and who's actually earned the largest number of votes. And so I think the next time around, we're going to be much clearer about what that choice should be.
We don't talk much about the Republican superdelegates. They exist, but they have far less power and autonomy than the superdelegates on the Democratic side. What are your thoughts about the Republican superdelegates? And it's this way because the parties set their own rules.
Right. Of course, the parties, in some sense, assert they're free to set their rules however they want. We should understand that's a stupid argument. Historically, again, in the South, the Democratic Party used to say, we have the right to pick our rules. We have the right to exclude blacks from voting in our primary process. And it took a number of years, but eventually we came around to realize that, you know, blacks were entitled to participate in the Democratic primary just as much as whites were. And I think the Democrats and the Republicans both have adopted a system which is excluding the largest, quote, party in America. They're called independents. Mm. There are more people who are independents, call themselves independents, than call themselves Republicans or call themselves Democrats. And what we've got to accept is that in the modern political America, people identifying with parties is a thing of the past, and that what we have to do is, if we're going to have systems for electing presidents that depend on these primary steps, everybody's got to have a right to participate, whether you're independent or not.
Right. And we're going to talk about that in just a few minutes, because it's also really important to get information out about our primary in California on June 7th. What do you think about the differences between the way the Democrats choose their nominee and the way the Republicans choose their nominee? Is one more Democratic than the other?
Well, you know, what's funny about this election cycle is the Republicans were incredibly open to including a large number of people in this primary process. And I'm sure many Republicans look over to the Democrats and think, boy, we should have been as disciplined as the Democrats were in shrinking the number of people who were participating. Because, you know, when you had those debates with 15 people on stage, that was just a circus, and it encouraged people to behave like circus clowns. That was the only way to get attention. And instead of, you know, contrasted with the Democratic debates where, when it was Hillary and Bernie, even when it included Martin O'Malley, those debates were substantive. They were real ideas. You watched them and you understood something about where these candidates stood. So I think that the Republicans are going to be thinking about how can they exercise more control up front to narrow the field in a way that makes it possible for people to understand what's at stake more effectively. And the Democrats, on the other hand, obviously I have a conflict of interest here because I ran a whole campaign that was premised on at least getting a chance to be in that debate, that for the debates in the Democratic Party, and the rules for access were changed at the last minute. So I kind of feel like they are a little bit overly aggressive in excluding people from the debates. But I think the Democrats have to ask the question whether this perception of protecting the front runner, which, of course, the Democratic National Committee has suffered. Debbie Wasserman Schultz has been criticized heavily for that, is really productive, or whether they ought to be more openly inclusive and supportive of everyone up front, so that by the end, people feel like the person who won because, in fact, they've garnered the largest number of support among Democrats.
And then do you think there should be any restrictions on how much power these parties have to make their own rules?
Yes, I do. I think we ought to be pragmatic in recognizing in an America where the largest proportion of people are independents, we can't have rules that exclude independents from the process of selecting candidates for president. So that limit, just like the limit on race, should be enforced against parties that want to exclude independents. I think it's good to have a diversity of systems. So the caucuses versus the primaries is a very important difference. Bernie has done extremely well in caucuses, winning 10 out of 12 caucuses so far. So that gives, obviously, underdogs a better chance to make their case. But I do think we can't have a system that is so systematically tilted against the opportunity of independents to participate.
Today we're speaking with Lawrence Lessig, professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. He's the author of many books, including Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Our Congress. Professor Lessig ran for president, as he said, on a single-issue platform of reforming campaign finance. And on April 15th, he was arrested for protesting with the group Democracy Spring in Washington, D.C. That group is calling for free and fair elections and an end to the corruption of big money in politics. Now, we are voting in California on June 7th, and there's some confusing information about voting, so I want to repeat this throughout the show. If you are voting for a Democratic or Libertarian candidate, you can either register with those parties or choose no party preference. Do not choose the American Independent Party, unless that's the party you want to be with. But the LA Times found that 500,000 people have registered with the ultra-conservative American Independent Party in California, thinking it's independent. It's not. In order to be independent, you have to be no party preference. Now, if you're voting Green or Republican, you must register with those parties. You cannot be no party preference. To confuse matters even more, if you live in San Francisco and you want to vote in the DCCC race, a very important race, you have to be a Democrat. You cannot be a Green or no party preference and vote for the DCCC race in San Francisco. Lawrence Lessig, people in California are really confused about these rules, and I should say you've got to check your registration and re-register by May 23rd in order to vote in the June 7th primary. So, Lawrence Lessig, did you just get what I said? I don't want to confuse people any further.
No, it's way too complicated for me. But fortunately, I left California because it was all too complicated, including those ballot measures. So, I'm free to a simple state of Massachusetts now.
Well, we even have 5 ballot measures just in San Francisco in June, and they're really not getting much media attention yet. But we will put all of this information on the website, and I'll repeat it throughout the show. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I wanted to, I think Professor Lessig intimated this already in an answer about private, places of business being free to discriminate or not against African Americans. But my question was that elections are public, operations, but they are run by private parties. The Democrats and the Republicans are private. And I wanted to ask what he thought specifically about closed primaries and why they should or should not be able to set up their own rules.
Well, that's a great question. My view is in the current political environment, where the largest percentage of people are not affiliated with the party, we can't cede control over the selection of the candidates for president to these minority parties. We instead have to have rules that allow all of us to participate in some form. Now, you could say, well, then register as a Democrat or register as a Republican. But there's no reason to force someone to accept the label of a party in that way, given what we know about the attitudes of people being much more open to independent, being independent of particular parties. So just like we came to recognize there was no good justification for these, quote, private entities excluding people on the basis of race, I don't think there's any good justification for them to exclude people on the basis of independence. It's a different exclusion. It's not racist. It's not because we hate independence or because we want to suppress the power of independence. I understand it's related to the idea of this is what it means to be a Democrat. But I think in the 21st century, that justification just fades. And we ought to recognize America is an independent nation. It's filled with independence. And if you're going to turn over the selection of president to political parties, at least allow the independents to have a voice in that process.
We have an email from Stephen who said, what is the advantage of being an independent? It's not like you have to pay dues when you're a Democrat, for example. So here in California, in February, Secretary of State Alex Padilla released a report that found 24% of California voters are no party preference. That is the term we use here to describe independents. That is up 3% since the last presidential election. Democratic registration in California is flat at 43%, while Republican registration is slightly dropping at 28%. GOP registration has dipped in California by about 3%. So, Professor Lessig, in California, the independent party is actually, well, not the independent party, but the people registering as an independent, no party preference, is growing faster than Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah, that's right. Although California is unique in a lot of ways, and it's unique in having a relatively small number of people as independent compared to the other parties. Nationally, they're actually the majority of people who would call themselves not affiliated. Now, the question was, what's the advantage? Well, one advantage is integrity, right? If you look in your heart of hearts and you say, I believe in the Democrats' view about, you know, gay rights or the right of a woman to choose, but I'm actually a fiscal conservative, so I don't feel comfortable calling myself a Republican or calling myself a Democrat, then there's no reason for us to force you to label yourself like that. That's number one. And number two, actually, in states like New Hampshire, there's a really important opportunity for independents to force candidates on both parties to address issues that are of interest to a wider proportion of the public than just the extreme right or the extreme left who happen to turn up and vote in the typical party primary. So what was really interesting in the New Hampshire primary this cycle is the large number of unaffiliated, or they're called undeclared in New Hampshire, who said they were choosing between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. That was their choice. And that reflected a kind of American who's not easily captured in the party platform Republican or party platform Democrat, because that is an American who's just so deeply frustrated with corruption or unresponsiveness of this government that they're willing to jump from one side to the other just to get a government that would be actually responsive. I don't think we have any good reason to try to suppress them from acting on that view. And I think we ought to encourage it more openly.
And how do the parties decide whether or not the primaries are open? Because today, Indiana independents can vote, but in New York, independents were not able to vote. 3 million independents could not vote in New York on April 19th.
Yeah, well, it's a local decision. It's a state decision. And there's lots of, pressure one way or the other, including just the pressure of inertia. This is the way it's always been. But I think we have to, really organize a stronger recognition of why it's wrong to be excluding this significant portion of America from participating in this really critical process of the election. You know, one of the problems we have in American government right now is because we've turned over so much power to the primaries, and the primaries are typically controlled by the extremes of each party, whether it's the Republican far right or the Democrat far left, that the candidates who are trying to get the approval of the primaries need to bend to those extremes. Well, you know, that's not America. That doesn't capture a reflection of exactly how America, the diversity of what America is. And we ought to find a way to include people who are not naturally so extreme into the political process so that our representatives actually represent us, not just the extremists on the left or the extremists on the right.
So what can be done about this? Because Democratic National Committee Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz was on MSNBC yesterday. She said, quote, "I believe that the party's nominee should be chosen by members of the party." So she says if it was up to her, she would exclude independents from Democratic primaries.
Well, you know, we shouldn't look to the insider qua insider to ask the question, what's the right way to set up a system that's inclusive of all Americans? Debbie Wasserman Schultz has been a team player for Team Democrats in a way that's been, you know, criticized by lots of people for being critical and restrictive in the inclusion that the Democratic Party has allowed. So I'm sure that's her view. That's appropriate for her view because they're trying to maximize power of Democrats alone. But if we're going to turn this process over to the parties, then the simple quid pro quo to the parties should be, okay, fine, just make sure all Americans can participate. Because if they can't, there's something wrong with the system you've set up.
Today we're speaking with Lawrence Lessig, professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. We're talking about the presidential nominating process. What do you think about it? Do you think it's democratic? What changes would you like to see? And I want to repeat information about California's primary on June 7th. If you are voting for a Democratic or Libertarian presidential candidate, you can either register with those parties or choose no party preference. If you are voting for the Green or the Republican candidate, you have to register with those parties. If you live in San Francisco and you want to vote in the DCCC race, you have to be registered as a Democrat, period. You have until May 23rd to register or change your registration. You can find out how you're registered online, and that primary is on June 7th. And if you have any questions about this, we'd love to hear from you. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or a question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show. Coming up in a half an hour at 11 o'clock, it's World Have Your Say from the BBC.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the Frisco Five hunger strike. Since April 21st, a grandmother, two rappers, an educator, and a supervisor candidate have chosen not to eat to protest the recent killings of Mario Woods, Alex Nieto, Amilcar Lopez, and Luis Gongora. The Frisco Five, who are camping out in front of the Mission Police Station, say they will not eat until Police Chief Greg Sir steps down. So what reforms are they calling for? How are city officials responding? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you'd like to join today's show, we're talking about the presidential nominating process. What questions do you have about it? How democratic do you think it is? If you have any questions or comments, give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Lawrence Lessig, professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. On April 15th, Professor Lessig was arrested for protesting with the Democracy Spring movement. They're calling for free and fair elections and an end to the corruption of big money and politics. Professor Lessig also ran for president on a single-issue platform of reforming campaign finance. And let's go to our next caller, William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. I hope I'm not confusing the issue more about who can vote for whom. But in distributing leaflets for Bernie Sanders, I found that a lot of people are confused. If you are declined to state, in other words, no party preference, then if you go to the polls, you can ask for a Democrat ballot if you go to the polls.
Right.
But 50% of the people, at least in Marin, vote absentee. And the difficulty is that you can, if you look at your absentee ballot, no party preference is what you declared as, you will find no presidential primary on it. At that point, you can call the voter registrar and ask them to send you a Democrat ballot if you're a no-party preference. The trouble comes for the absentees because they may not look at their ballot until, say, 6 days before the election because they want to vote and send it in. The trouble is they won't have the presidential election on it, the primary, and they can call the registrar of voters to get another absentee ballot, but it'll be too late to send it in. So that they actually then will have to go to the polls and ask for a ballot for the Democrats so they could vote in the Democrat primary. Hmm. But if they work or something and that wasn't part of their plan, they will find it difficult.
Wow. Well, thank you, William. That adds even a little more confusion. So maybe your best bet would be to re-register if you're going to vote, for example, for a Democrat or a Green or Republican, re-register with those parties. So again, just to reiterate these rules because it can be confusing. If you're voting for a Democrat or a Libertarian in California on our June 7th primary, you can register with those parties or no party preference. If you're voting for a Green or a Republican, you have to register with those parties. If you live in San Francisco and you want to vote in the San Francisco's Democratic County Central Committee, DCCC race for short, you have to be registered as a Democrat. The Chronicle had a really good piece about what's at stake yesterday. People who serve on the DCCC, the Democratic Central County Committee, endorse power and they have a very powerful ability to push a political agenda. So this is important. If you want to vote in that race in San Francisco, you have to be a Democrat. You cannot be a Green and you cannot be no party preference. You have until May 23rd to check your register or change your registration. And the primary is on June 7th. So thank you also for that information, William, because I hadn't heard about that, and that's really important. Let's go next to Brian in San Francisco. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thanks so much for the show. I have a comment and a question. One is, I believe that the polls are going to be proving to be wrong, just like they were wrong in the last presidential election. The headlines all over the world the day after the election will be that the American people elect the first woman president of the United States and that California and Utah legalize marijuana for adults over 21. My question is, I don't understand how you can rely on the parties, Republicans and Democrats, to let the independents in because they're not, you know, party members. There's no logic in it, and it just can't be done internally. It's the responsibility of the American people to organize themselves for their own political will, so the American people should be organizing the Democracy Spring, you know, party, or the American Moderate Independent Party, or, you know, I think this trend, you know, with the small donations for Bernie, you know, overturning, you know, the political environment in America trends well towards a third party, an independent, moderate party, whatever you want to call it. But it's the responsibility of those people to organize their own party and express their own political will. So I don't understand how you can be, you know, for independence organizing through the Democrats or the, you know, Republican Party.
All right. Thank you, Brian. Professor Lessig, what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, first, it's clear how to do it. There are plenty of states that have open primaries, number one. Number two, I just think we have to be realistic about just how powerful the duopoly of Democrats and Republicans in America is right now. You know, you can't be on stage as an independent debating in the fall unless you receive 15% of the vote of the poll number support at the, you know, a couple weeks before that debate. That's a percentage that even Ross Perot would not qualify for right now. The system is set up to make it incredibly difficult for outsider independents to compete fairly inside the system. Now, many of us believe we should be fixing this problem generally. We should be creating a system that's more open to independents to be able to have their own party or to run separate from Republicans and Democrats. And I think that would actually be a good step. But my point is a much smaller point. In the interim, if we're going to live in this world of the duopoly of Democrat and Republican control, endless number of rules that make it so hard to run unless you happen to be a member of one of those two parties, then the least we can do is to allow this significant majority of Americans to participate equally in the selection of the candidates who's going to be able to run for office. And we know how to do it. Open primaries do it quite easily. There's no problem with running it in that way.
Well, we're getting a few emails about third parties, specifically the Greens. And I'll admit, we have done a pretty bad job of reporting on what's happening with the Green Party. And single-payer advocate Margaret Flowers is a Green Party candidate for a Senate seat in Maryland. She says that she received two invites to a recent debate, and then she was disinvited. So she went to the debate recently, got kicked off the stage, and the crowd was shouting, "Let her speak." So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think this is part of this really incredible kind of conspiracy to narrow America's choice into the Democrat-Republican category, when America is not like that. You know, and that's one of the points about, if you look at the nature of the, quote, independents, they aren't just people who are somewhere in the middle between Republicans and Democrats. They actually have a very eclectic mix of views, and we ought to encourage that diversity, because obviously the incumbent parties are not doing a terribly good job in representing America and passing legislation that Americans like.
We have a related question. Let's hear from Vince in San Francisco. Hi, Vince. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. Yeah, up until the last callers and emails, that the discussion was a little too simplistic. And, you know, parties exist for a reason. They represent people, and they elect a nominee that represents them. And you can't have one nominee for each person. So you kind of have to have a party in order to build a coalition and have some strength and represent people in government. So, you know, yeah, let's talk more about building alternative parties and facilitating that. You know, when you have an organization or a movement like Bernie Sanders putting together this sort of coalition, certainly it's possible. And, yeah, he did it through the Democratic Party this time, but I think it's inspiration for people in an example where it could be done by someone else with an independent party. And also with open primaries, I could see where the parties would really object to having open primaries, because you could have people from a different party sabotage the leader in your party by voting for someone who's unlikely to win in the general election. So, you know, I could see where these parties would object to that. And parties are sort of, aren't they kind of like private organizations in a way? And can't they kind of set their own rules and agendas? So I'll leave it at that.
All right. Thank you.
Well, so it's true. In theory, you could see people playing all sorts of games with open primaries, but we have a pretty extensive experience with open primaries, and we don't see behavior like that. In fact, it strengthens the support for the ultimate candidate. It doesn't weaken the support for the ultimate candidate. And you're right, parties are an essential part of politics. I support the idea of political parties. I'm not somebody who believes we ought to weaken political parties. Indeed, right now, political parties have more restrictions on their ability to amass resources to support candidates than do super PACs, and that's ridiculous. They ought to be the central part of how a democracy works. But America's democracy restricts parties, alternative parties, much more heavily than any other competitive democracy around the world. We are more restrictive. We have more rules at the local level, at the state level, to make it incredibly difficult for the Green Party or any alternative party to be able to compete in a level playing field with other candidates. And so if we live in that world, my only point is an interim step to making it so the vast majority of America, or the majority, you know, the plurality of Americans who don't identify with one party and the other exclusively, to have a role, is to at least allow them to participate the way open primaries do.
David writes in and says the state of California has a great website. If you're confused about your registration status, the server will direct you to the county appropriate to your search. You enter your ID, and then you can pull up your profile. Then you can also change your preference. Within 15 days, the DMV receives and changes this information, and it's relayed through the state servers. And we'll put links to those websites at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for that information, David. Today we are talking about the presidential party nominating process with Lawrence Lessig, professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. Professor Lessig ran for president on a single-issue platform of reforming campaign finance. And if you have any questions or comments about this process, what do you think about it overall? Is there anything you would change? Do you think it's democratic? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Howard writes in and says, I saw Charlie Rose interview Jimmy Carter. When Charlie Rose asked whether the Carter Center would certify free and fair elections in the United States, Carter laughed out loud and long. He said that with different procedures from state to state and even county to county, they could not. And in a speech in 2013, Jimmy Carter said the United States is no longer a functioning democracy. And a recent study basically said the same thing based on the voting system in this country. So Howard's question is, could we establish a national election system? And if so, how?
Well, I don't think we should abolish the election system at the state level. We need to impose principles that should apply across all election systems. One really important principle is that people have an opportunity to be represented by having a fair opportunity to vote. That means their vote's not suppressed the way it is in many parts of the country through voter ID systems or other ways to exclude the opportunity of people to vote. It means not to have gerrymandered district make it so that certain people's views are irrelevant because they happen to be a minority in a safe seat district that would benefit the majority the whole time. Those are principles that ought to exist across the election system from the top to the bottom. But I also think it's really important for us to recognize how voting is increasingly becoming the irrelevant stage in the process of selecting our representatives. Now, I'm not thinking about the president as much, but I'm thinking about the selection of Congress. The most important primary, if you're running for Congress, is not the Democratic primary or the Republican primary. It's the money primary. It's the primary where you demonstrate to the party or to other people in the race that you're able to raise enough money to qualify to be able to be a credible candidate in that election. Now, that money election, that money primary, is not a primary where we all have a chance to vote. Forget independent Republican Democrat. The people who vote in that primary are the tiniest fraction of the 1% of Americans. Mm. And when Jimmy Carter laughs at the idea that we have free and fair elections, I think one part of that is his recognition, as he stated again and again, of how distorted and corrupted this system has become because we've allowed the role of money to become so dominant. It is radically different from how it was when he was president. It's really over the last 20 years that we've seen this cancer grow the way it has. And that, I think, is ultimately a much more corrosive effect on the opportunity for us to have something like a representative democracy than anything like superdelegates, or I'd even say than the way we exclude independents from presidential primaries. Mm.
We had Jane Mayer on a couple months ago talking about her book Dark Money, in which she reveals that so much outsider money coming from the Koch network, for example, they used North Carolina as a testing ground. And even the moderate Republicans were blindsided by these conservative Republicans that came in with so much money, and the moderates just didn't stand a chance.
Yeah, and that's because this big super PAC money is typically driven, just like the primary votes, to extremes. What happened in the Republican primary, when Donald Trump could stand up and call out these extremists because of the money they were getting from the super PAC, changed the election dramatically. But because most, even in the Republican Party, recognized how this big money had corrupted the process so dramatically.
And so what can be done about this? You got arrested recently with 1,400 people in Washington, D.C. Democracy Spring is calling for free and fair elections and an end to the corruption of money in politics. According to the Huffington Post, these protests and these arrests have prompted about 100 members of Congress to call for hearings on voting rights and campaign finance reform legislation.
Yeah, well, that's what's got to happen. What's so frustrating to me in this election cycle is, though candidates have been quite good in making clear the corrupting effect of money inside of our politics, they've been really bad in giving people a clear sense of what we can do about it. You know, most people think the solution is, Supreme Court reversing Citizens United. But we have to remember, on January 20th, 2010, the day before Citizens United was decided, it was not as if we had a swimming democracy in America, right? Democracy was already dead. The Supreme Court might have shot the body, but the body was already cold. So we have to recognize the transformation we need is much bigger than fixing the mistake of the Supreme Court. And what the candidates have not done is explain to the American people what we could do. What I was so excited about with Democracy Spring is that they were talking about specific legislation that would radically change the way Congress was affected by big money. And the most important of those changes is change the way candidates fund their campaigns. Republican proposals for giving people vouchers, where every voter gets a voucher they can give to candidates who take small-dollar contributions. Democratic proposals for matching grants, where a small contribution can be matched under John Sarbanes' proposal up to 9-1. These are all ways for making it so that candidates don't raise their money from the tiniest fraction of the 1%. They raise their money from all of us. And what we need more than anything are politicians willing to say the hard truth that if we don't change the way we fund campaigns, we won't fix our government. He who pays the piper calls the tune. And we don't pay the piper now. It's the special interests and big wealthy donors and unions that pay the piper, and that's why they get to call the tune.
Do you think Bernie Sanders has done enough on this? He often talks about the fact that his average donation is $27. His campaign has raised a whopping $210 million from about 4 million individuals. And the Washington Post had a piece basically saying, well, Bernie raised the money differently, but he's spending it like every other candidate, spending so much money on consultants and television ads, for example.
Well, I think the question is not, in my mind, how you spend it. That's determined by what works. The question is how you raise it. And, of course, I think Bernie has done an extraordinary job in raising money from small contributions and not taking money from the super PAC. But we can't be confused by the economy of the presidency. We've got to focus on the broken institution in our government. That's Congress. And no Congress can elect itself or will elect itself with small-dollar contributions averaging at $27 a contributor. It's Congress that needs to have the system changed. And the only way we'll get there is if our politicians talk about it. And so though I am incredibly encouraged by Bernie talking about money, money, money every time he turns around, what I'm upset about is that he's only using it for the purpose of attacking Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. He's not using it to explain to us that, in fact, there is something we could do tomorrow to radically change the corruption inside of our Congress. Every time the question of changing the way campaigns are funded is raised with Bernie Sanders, what he says is this is something he wants to move to, quote, in the long term. And my view is, well, what are you going to do in the short term? Because none of the things you're talking about are even credible until we change the power of money in Congress. Congress is the problem. It's not the president who's the problem. And we have to have a conversation about fixing Congress if we're going to ever have a government that can work.
Well, we have a related question about your campaign finance reform campaign. Let's hear from Alicia in Berkeley. Hi, Alicia. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to see if your guests could give an update on that campaign. I did contribute to it, but I have not done a very good job of following what you're currently doing. And then I also wanted to ask a kind of a out-of-left-field question is, what good is the primary process at all, and why don't we just go back to having conventions and picking a candidate at a national convention?
Well, there's lots to criticize with the primary system, but what I like about the primary system is that it gives people a chance to prove themselves over time. Now, it shouldn't be 3 years or 2 years the way it effectively is right now. But, you know, the point is people don't focus quickly or immediately on who the candidate should be. And if it were, you know, a single convention held 6 weeks or 2 months before the election, then it would be very hard for outsiders to have a chance the way Bernie has to have some success. As to the campaign to push to change the way campaigns are funded, there are lots of amazing groups doing great stuff out there. I was involved with a group called May Day. They're involved in a number of campaigns this election cycle. Every Voice and Represent Us are also keenly focused on trying to elect candidates who are going to work to change the system. And what we need is more people to support that kind of change, because if we can get enough members in Congress committed to changing the way campaigns are funded, then we have a chance to get this democracy back. That's the critical change we need. And it's clear the politicians are not eager to talk about that.
Well, and a related question from a listener over email. A lot of Green Party members are right in line with what you're talking about on campaign finance, Professor Lessig. But they really stand no chance running against a Democrat. And so their only choice in the system is to maybe flip to a Democrat and run as a Dem. I mean, how do you deal with that?
Well, that's true. And as long as we fund elections by turning to rich people and corporations and unions, then the people who are running will all be competing for the same money. And it's only if we change the way we fund elections. You know, imagine everybody had a $50 voucher sent back to them from the government. Your first $50 in taxes are going to return to you in a voucher. And you could use that to give to anybody who said they're going to raise their campaign money from small contributions and vouchers only. Then the Green Party or other parties would have a real shot, because the way you'd be getting money is not talking to the same small number of large funders. You'd be talking to everybody. And that's the real opportunity to begin to multiply the number of possible parties. It's the real opportunity to change the influence of big money inside of our system.
Lawrence Lessig is professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. He was arrested last month with the Democracy Spring movement that's calling for free and fair elections and an end to the corrupting influence of money in politics. Professor Lessig, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss the Frisco Five hunger strike. Since April 21st, a grandmother, two rappers, an educator, and a supervisor candidate have chosen not to eat to protest the recent killing of Mario Woods, Alex Nieto, Amilcar Lopez, and Luis Gongora. The Frisco Five, who are camping out in front of the Mission Police Station, say they won't eat until Police Chief Greg Sir steps down or resigns. So how are city officials responding? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.